This is April 26th, the sixth Sunday during the period of the suspension of regular services due to the coronavirus pandemic. But we are hearing good things from our government in Austin, and it looks like some restrictions are going to be lifted this coming week, and we will be able to gather together as a congregation again this coming Lord's Day. We'll probably have to scatter out throughout the auditorium, but we'll at least try to be together on Sunday morning of this coming Lord's Day, if all things are in order. This morning, I want us to think about a few facts concerning the faith. Now, this is not novel. It's not something that we don't know, but it's something that bears repeating and emphasizing. We need to stress truthful concepts to ourselves all the time because of the battering that truth receives in the world. And we are tempted sometimes to forget or neglect or not to emphasize truth in our lives by the world that lives a different way. The devil is always trying to find weaknesses in our spirits, ways that he can penetrate our hearts. He's trying to find avenues of destruction. And so it behooves each of us to stay biblically oriented, reminding ourselves of the gospel, thinking always about the truth and how the truth is to be lived out and thought about, or in another word, applied to our everyday living. Jude, one of the Lord's brothers, wrote a little book. It's the book right before the last book of our New Testament. And he was going to write to some brethren with regard to the salvation that he and they shared. He called it our common salvation. But as he was planning to write this particular book, something stirred him or compelled him. The Spirit wanted him to go in a different direction. And he says, I was compelled, as it were, I was constrained to write unto you, exhorting you to contend earnestly for the faith which was once for all delivered unto the saints. Now, the faith hadn't finished being written. Jude was writing about it here. The book of Revelation was yet to come. So the story had not been completely told, though, at least in summation form and capsule form, the faith had already been delivered. The gospel story, the fundamentals of the faith, the permanent principles of truth, these had already been given. And they had been given out to various people in various cities in various ways. But Jude says you have to contend for, you have to wrestle for the faith. Don't let the devil or anyone else rob you of the faith. It is a precious thing. You recall in the parables of Jesus that he would sometimes liken the kingdom to various things. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes it had to do with some, like a pearl of great price or a hidden treasure, something of tremendous value. Sometimes the parables told other lessons. But sometimes he would zero in on the extraordinary worth of truth and the kingdom, the gospel and the church. And it's a sad thing when people walk out and leave the gospel, no longer remain faithful members of the church. And that's one of the reasons why, of course, we always want to gather together as far as we can in our regular services to help to encourage each other, and as Jude would later say, even in this book, to build each other up in the most holy faith. That's not a common thing. That's not an unimportant thing. To keep each other stirred up, to provoke unto love and good works. Let me mention just a few of the facts concerning the faith. Number one, the truth would always be distinguishable from the lie. Now, this is the way that it goes in the gospel. There was such a thing as the truth, and there was also such a thing as the lie. The lie was anything other than the truth. Now, of course, in the gospel accounts and in Acts and throughout Revelation, when God has one of his prophets or an apostle or a writer say something about truth, it is about religious truth. It is about spiritual truth. It is about saving truth. It's not about science, for example. It's not about grammar, the truth regarding grammar in a particular language. It's not something that has to do even with just history as such. It's about truth that affects your spirit here and in eternity. When Jesus said, "I am the way and the truth and the life," he was not focusing upon mathematical truth. He was focusing upon the truth whereby a person could come to the Father through him. Now, that's an important category of truth. It's the most extraordinary information that is available. I'm concerned about the salvation of my soul, and you're concerned about the salvation of your soul. And so as the Bible talks about these things, it talks about the truth, which Jesus personified, and the lie, which was anything other than that. In 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 10 through 12, Paul speaks of it that way, that God was going to send a working of error, that some brethren should believe the lie, that they might all be judged who believed not the truth, but had pleasure in the unrighteousness. Now it's interesting there, because three times in the Greek text, he will use that definite article for the lie, for the truth, and for the unrighteousness. You've got categories. So if you think in terms of circles, you know, you've got a circle that embraces truth. You've got a circle that's got the lie. You've got a circle that's got the righteousness. You've got a circle that has the unrighteousness. And the gospel of Christ would always be the truth that saves our souls. And it would be distinguishable. And so it had to be fought for. And as you remember the book of Acts, as the apostles preached the gospel throughout the whole world, and as other brethren helped in that effort, there was controversy. The truth had to be announced, it had to be advocated, it had to be practiced, and it had to be defended. There was a war on with regard to the truth. 1 John 2 and verse 21, John would later say, long after Pentecost, but he would say, "No lie is of the truth." This is a matter of definition, of course. Truth is one thing, falsehood is another. If it's false, it's not true. If it's true, it's not false. If it's a lie, it cannot be true. God does not lie. Hebrews 6, 18, Titus 1 and verse 2. It is impossible for him to do that. But John 8, 44 says the devil is the father of lies. So there again, these fundamental truths and characteristics, features of the faith, would always be permanent throughout the gospel dispensation. Jesus had expressed it really in John 8, 32. Your ultimate freedom comes from the truth. And this is what is good for us. If ye abide in my word, then are ye truly my disciples, and ye shall know the truth. And the truth shall make you free. That suggests, among other things, that truth has always been, it always will be, it can only be good for us. When somebody attacks the truth, when somebody despises the truth, he likely does not understand how much he's cutting his own throat. People do sad things. People do calamitous and disastrous things. But throughout Scripture, truth, God's saving truth, it has always been good for us. It would be the thing that Paul says the church would always support. 1 Timothy 3 and verse 15. When the church stops supporting the truth, the church stops being faithful to God. Its candlestick has been removed to the degree that it no longer supports the gospel, the saving gospel of Christ. In Genesis 3, the lesson there is early on taught to Adam and Eve and to all of us in time. Sin kills. The devil lies. God always tells the truth. Number two, as a fact concerning the faith, the truth would be practiced by the faithful. Now, as I've already suggested, the truth has to be a part of our mental makeup by faith. It will become entrenched in our hearts as a conviction. We will be convicted by the truth. There are things that we believe, things that we surely believe. But as we believe these things, they have effect in overt act and in thoughts that we produce. In our lives, we don't live one way and have a doctrine that goes the other way. We are able to live out the truth in our lives. Sometimes philosophers will philosophize one way and they will reach conclusions that they can't practice in their private lives. I don't know how they live with themselves that way, but sometimes philosophers have done that in the past. Philosophy leads them to one conclusion, but they know they cannot live it, but they don't give the conclusion up. In Christianity, faithful Christians, we adopt a view. We adopt the view of God for us in this world. It is the truth. And we live that out in our lives. We are to live and practice the truth. 1 John 3 and verse 18, we're not to love just in word only, John says. Now, we ought to have loving words. We ought to love in word, but not word only, saying, I love you, and then act like I don't love you. But he says, we have to love in deed and truth. Deed. Now the deed, that's the overt act, and the deed needs to be in harmony with the truth that authorizes the deed. So, we do love in our hearts, and we do love with our words, but it's not just talk. We often say talk is cheap. Oh, people are going to do this. Oh, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I've got great plans, and I commit myself to the doing of this and that. Talk is cheap. And you can say you love God and you love the truth and you love the church and you love righteousness and not mean a word of it. It may play well among the ignorant and the uninformed. John says, we Christians, we realize we must love in deed and in truth. And in Hebrews 5, verses 13 and 14, we know that we exercise ourselves unto godliness. It's not just something in our minds, but it's something in our spiritual parts, our spiritual bodies. We exercise ourselves unto godliness. It sometimes takes great effort. It takes much strength. It takes strain. It takes a great will to live and do what we are supposed to do. Number three, another fact concerning the faith is that the faithful would always in unity be confronted by division. And this has always been such a discouraging thing. Let me say it again. One of the features that would always characterize the ongoing nature of the faith in our world would be that the faithful would, in their unity, always be called upon by God to confront division. We see a certain amount of it in the world, even though there's a certain thing that ties the world together. But we see a lot of division in the world. But the sad thing is, and historically it's true, and it goes all the way back to the New Testament days, there has been a monumental amount of tension and strife and envy and jealousy and backbiting and heresy that has characterized various congregations over time. In Matthew chapter 10, Jesus had already told us all long, long ago that you should not expect perfect unity in Christianity. Now, that's what he wants. But he says, the religion that I am bringing, the truth that I am announcing, it's a sword, verse 34. He's getting his apostles ready to announce the coming of the kingdom. And they're going to announce that throughout the Jewish people, the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But he says, think not that I came to send peace on the earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. For I came to set a man at variance against his father. He's talking about the inevitable fallout. What will inevitably occur when this new message is preached? And even in households, one person will want it, another will not. And there you go. One person will want it, one will not. And there will be division over that. He wants all men to have it. God wants all men to be saved. But the fact of the matter is, he says, as the message is preached to people, some of whom will want it, some of whom won't. So you have to get ready for that. You have to be ready for that. And the truth itself is more valuable than the relationship that might obtain between you and that person who turns it down. Now, that is a truth that sometimes people are not willing to face up to. They'd rather have the relationship with someone who's not going to practice truth than to have a relationship with God that is based on truth. But Jesus is saying that the sword is a spiritual sword. It's real. There will be division. You have to be willing to face that over truth, because of truth, with the truth, in the light of the truth. And sometimes that's terribly hard to take in life. Later, after the church had been established, and Paul is writing to the church at Corinth, he brings up this facet of this point. He says in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, he says, I hear that even when you brethren come together, it's not for your good, it's for your non-benefit. You come together for the worse. Verse 17. For first of all, when you come together in church, I hear that divisions exist among you. And I partly believe it. For there must be also heresies or factions among you, that they that are approved may be made manifest among you. Now that is a sobering announcement that he makes in this somewhat lengthy treatise that he writes to them. The church of Corinth had so many problems and so many sins that were there. And Paul takes the optimistic, the long-range view of things, and he says, now look, there will always be divisions over truth and righteousness. Right doctrine, right practice. How can you get to the point where when you come together, it's not even to your benefit? Imagine how weak and how uninformed they had become. How awful the church had become. It wasn't even possible for them to scripturally partake of the Lord's Supper. But he says, you know, this is a weeding out process. You have the good and you have the evil. And sometimes in a congregation, it can depend on where it's geographically located, the backgrounds of the people that have entered the kingdom, how busy the devil is in that locale right at this current moment. It may depend on various things, but things can go wild and crazy and horribly wrong. And sometimes, if you're as weak and uninformed as some of these brethren were, you don't even see a lot of that. But Paul says in the gospel, one of the facts of the gospel, while the faithful will always in unity face opposition, there will be opposition. And the opposition will be providentially, in the providence of God, a weeding out process, so that to God and angels and informed men, it will be clear who is standing for the truth and who is not. Division is a good thing in that sense. In Ephesians chapter 4, verses 1 and 2, of course, the positive side of it, what we are to pursue is the unity. The unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. But the unity of the Spirit drives us to confront devilish division. That is, wrong doctrine absorbed, wrong practice experienced. The faithful, always in unity, will confront the heresy and the corruption, the division that they bring. Number four. The devil would always seek to destroy the good. This is another fact concerning the faith. 1 Peter 5 and verse 10, he's always going to be after us. Ephesians 6, 10 and following, we fight against the world rulers of this darkness, the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. We fight the devil and his forces, and he's always busy. He always wants to destroy the good. It's not as though we don't have an enemy. We've always had an enemy. We always will have an enemy. Even if you are, during your lifetime, wonderfully situated in a culture that is somewhat favorable, or at least it allows you. Your leeway, it gives you leeway to live and to practice what God has told us to do. Even if you're so situated as to have what might appear to be somewhat of a cultural favor, the devil is still seeking to destroy. And he may try to change the cultural disposition toward the church to make it harder on us to believe and practice the things that we do, so that we will in time give up those things and join the world, join the lost. Do not underestimate the power and the presence of the devil and the strength of temptation. And do not for a moment think that you do not need help with temptation and overcoming the sins of this world. You know, the New Testament is remarkable in the warnings that it gives with regard to those things. And in those letters to the churches of Asia, in chapters 2 and 3 of Revelation, the writer John, or Jesus through the writer John, is always telling those congregations, now you have to overcome. You need to overcome. And if you overcome, I'll do this for you. I'll give you this. But you have to overcome. How do we overcome temptation? How do we overcome the devil? How do we overcome discouragement? I tell you what, if there is a way for the devil to get me to be discouraged, he's trying to find it. He's trying to find a way to make me think it's time to quit. It is not worth it. I am tired of living in faith. Oh, what a mistake it is when people give up salvation. And they give up approaching victory because an invisible enemy, our president has been referring to this virus as an invisible enemy, because our real invisible enemy, the devil, is seeking our destruction. But because people don't see him, and then they don't really think in terms of what God in his word has told us about him, they finally surrender to him, and so they cannot overcome. God knows our discouragements. He knows what makes me sad. He knows how long my sorrow lasts. He knows how to lift my spirits. He knows how to act in providence so as to make it practical for me to go forward in truth. Don't discount the help of friend or even the unintentional help of foe. Don't discount the providence of angels. Don't discount the power of prayer. Don't discount the power of the Word and the power of the blood and the power of fellowship. The devil would always seek to destroy the good. Let me make one more point this morning, and that is that the religion itself would always be pure and internally driven. You know, since we have been for some time now without full congregational support in our worship services and a Bible class, it makes this point even more significant that while we rely on each other, as we should, and we try to help each other, and we should, we have had a lot of time to individually think about our soul. We've had a lot of time in quietness and in solitude to think about Scripture and to think about how we've lived and how we are living and perhaps what lies ahead and what God's promises mean and say to us and how it all is going. And we think about the internal nature of the kingdom. We are to congregate. Hebrews 10:25, and as soon as we can, we're going to do that. But what if you can't? Remember in Luke 17:20-21, Jesus says, don't say, there's the kingdom. Over there, there's the kingdom. He said, the kingdom is within you. This fact concerning the faith is extraordinary. I obeyed the gospel from my heart or my spirit. Romans 6:17. Romans 14:17. Paul would say, well, the kingdom is not eating and drinking. Now, we may get together for a love feast as the first century church did sometimes. We may have a meal together. But what is the kingdom? It's righteousness and joy and peace and Holy Spirit. Well, that sounds like Jesus. The kingdom is within you. So, the religion itself would be internally driven, and the religion itself would be pure. James 1:27. Pure religion, undefiled religion, before God the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and the widows in their afflictions, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. Now, isn't that something? The world stands before God in its corruption. It stands before God in its contamination, its soiled condition. It's evil. The sin is pervasive. It's out there. It's entrenched. It's overwhelming. But there's pure religion. How do you get out of that? Out of that squalor? Out of that cesspool of a way to live? The gospel retrieves us, calls us to the cross, calls us to the throne of God. Come! Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden. I will give you rest. And so there's the forfeiture of misery, and there's relief of spirit when we hear and obey the gospel of Christ. What an amazing thing. And then you're able by the blood of Christ to stand before God holy and pure. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. What a promise. What a platform. Of course it is a condition, but that's the way it would always be. There would be times when there would be corruption in congregations, and when you read those letters to the churches of Asia, you will find there are things, and some of them, that were wrong because there was doctrine that was tolerated, that was awful, and there were things that were going on there of an immoral sort that should never have been tolerated. But the faithful church would always, the faithful religion would always be pure and driven from its internal spirit. May God help us as we think about His will and our lives on this earth to to always think about fundamental truths and facts, as it were, concerning the faith.